Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a discussion of technology and its relationship to culture and democracy. I'm joined by two young media theorists who are grappling with this question. Ben Peters is an assistant professor of communications at the University of Tulsa, where he coordinates the Digital Studies Group, which brings together faculty, students, and professionals from a wide variety of fields to talk about this intersection between culture and technology. They, in turn, have invited my other guest, Bernard Gagan, a research associate at the Humboldt University of Berlin, who will be speaking tonight on the TU campus at 6:30 in the Chapman Hall Lecture Hall. He'll be discussing the German term and terminology of Kulturtechnik, an idea that's at the heart of this question of man and technology. Gagan, prior to moving to Berlin, was a Javits Fellow and a visiting fellow at the Institute for Research and Innovation at the Centre Pompidou in Paris. He was also a visiting professor at the American University there. Again, he'll be speaking tonight at 6:30. Bernard Gagan and Ben Peters are my guests today. Gentlemen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Bernard, you're going to be talking about the German term Kulturtechnik. It's culture and technology?
Correct.
What does this term mean in German today?
Well, what's great about it is it's really difficult to say what it means, precisely because the terms don't translate well into English. And it's not because there's anything wrong with English so much as a word like culture, a word like technology has its history, right? And it's related to the history of a land, a people, a language. So the term culture is a lot easier because it's closer to the English. It can, on one hand, mean something like civilization, that's a higher sense. It can also have a kind of
art,
literature, and it can also have a kind of everyday sense. So you might say that there's a different culture in southern Germany than northern Germany, right?
Social mores and things like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Technik is much more interesting because it can mean techniques, it can mean technology, and it can also mean this old-fashioned word, techniques, which is sort of, it's basically, you can think about the way a society organizes its techniques and its practices of production, right? And so this term Kulturtechnik is this way in Germany people are trying to conceptualize how is it that culture and technology work together. But what's great about when you say this in German, you don't have to choose between techniques, which are human, and technology, which are instruments. You can sort of say both at the same time. But the Germans, the final thing we'll be saying, the Germans don't think about the fact that they're saying both at the same time. They just do it.
And so this idea that these two ways of thinking of techniques, whether it's technology or the human side of it, is sort of welded together automatically. And there's no way really in other languages to do that.
Not certainly on English. The French have it. The French have la technique. Whereas in English, you had this funny thing. So in the 1820s, this professor at Harvard came up with the idea of technology as a way of saying that's the way that we turn the practical arts like building and printing into something systematic and rational. And he said that's different than, you know, these everyday techniques that we practice. You can see why that was a useful term to have in the 19th century. But in a certain sense, it creates, when once you have that new word, it creates a division in how we think about culture between the everyday practices of humans and their techniques, and technology, which increasingly becomes this kind of scary machine. So Kulturtechnik is this way of saying, let's think about the history of our society in terms of how instruments, techniques, practices work together to sort of make our society function.
But both of you, really in the 21st century, those things which used to be separate, the technology from, you know, people, is now merging. Mm-hmm. I mean, oftentimes we think of one another not as having a conversation with you. I'm going to be separated from you. I'm text messaging. I'm communicating remotely via Skype from halfway across the world. Or you might be five offices down, but I'm going to text you rather than get up and walk over and talk to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's sort of the sense of where we are in the 21st century, that these worlds are certainly melding together.
Absolutely. I think that's a very fine point. It brings us back to the relevance of taking these sort of historical perspectives on what our language and our culture and our national lands and people inheritance give us. It's exactly that we get to realize that where we are right now is actually not so historically weird, and that in many ways the 21st century resembles a much longer tradition 18th, 19th century.
Now, people hear that. They're not going to make that connection. I think technology is such a part of our everyday existence now that, I mean, we think we're living a brave new world every day.
Well, in some ways, the brave new world is a return to a recognition of things past, in which, say, in a world before all the cyber digital gizmos, in which, you know, we were bound to how we could communicate to our daily practices, in which we didn't have instant long-distance, instantaneous electronic communication. Instead, you had to send letters and horses and, you know, regular material ways of contacting people. Well, in that moment, communication and transportation are merged. People are interacting using day-to-day techniques as if they were technologies themselves. And I think one of the value of this type of concept is it gets us to think about our own present-day moment and to historicize it and kind of say it's normal if you look at the very big picture.
When you look at that word in German, Kulturtechnik, I would assume that was sort of coined in, what, the 19th century when you first started seeing things like telegraph?
You know, if you get to the history of the word, it gets even more.
Well, actually, you know, when I Googled it and you know, Wikipedia'd it and tried to translate it from German, it comes up with farming techniques.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is why. So this is Ben and I have been talking about this a bit, philology, looking at the history of a word. On one hand, it seems like a kind of obscure practice, and it is, but it's also incredibly enlightening because. So in the 19th century, it was Kulturtechnik was this term used to describe agricultural engineering because the word Kultur came from cultivation, farming.
Yeah, right.
And technique was just, again, being used for techniques and rational practices. And so in the 19th century, you have this split in Germany and in other countries between traditional practices and increasingly rational practices. And so this conjunction of Kulturtechnik in the 19th century was this way of saying, okay, we have old practices of farming, and we have new technologies for doing it. So we're going to come up with this word, Kulturtechnik. And then in the 20th century, it was coined again, probably in the 70s or 80s, to start referring to things like reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? Where they're saying, that's the basic techniques of a culture, you know? So it's a kind of Eurocentric.
It was sort of the long way of saying the three R's, as we would say.
Exactly. And now it's being reclaimed again to start saying, well, maybe throughout history, there's varying configurations of cultural techniques, technologies, instruments, and we need to start thinking about how we talk about these different configurations in history as being distinct, but also this is a returning problem that sort of every society or culture deals with. Mm. How do you reconcile and organize a society around instruments and people and change and so on?
Certainly, it seems like it's happening organically. I mean, it happens. People figure out ways to do this, right?
You know, they do. I think I have this feeling that the ways that we talk about technology, I think they're very impoverished. So one of the things you see in America, right, in everywhere, in almost every kind of like modern so-called Western country, there's this constant search for, you know, you have a problem and you want technology to fix it. You know, and there's this notion that somehow technology just comes in and resolves whatever's wrong in society, right? If you go back to the 70s, cable television originally was seen as a way of reforming the city. I mean, you had ghettos in the inner city, and you wanted to use, we had cable technology and better connections, somehow then communities that were isolated would be brought together.
Right, and I think every technological innovation is thought of as an educational device.
Absolutely.
You know, a way of advancing the society, and commercial interest mm-hmm. end up coming in. That's how Bravo went from the arts and culture channel to the Housewives series, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's really, that sort of goes hand in hand with technology is commercial innovation mm-hmm. and commercial exploitation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Take a parallel field and look at some of the promise and euphoria surrounding what can be done in terms of politics and the internet. I mean, I think if you looked at the 2008 election and you ask most commentators today what really marks it as distinct from others, we'll talk about the internet as a way of galvanizing and mobilizing a new section of the demographic, of bringing in new amounts of money. Certainly that's a sort of commercial element, but it's this idea, this story we'd like to tell ourselves that there's a new form of politics and it's taking place increasingly online. Now that may be true, but that certainly doesn't mean that those politics themselves are thanks to the technology. but that there's actually simultaneously another set of techniques or ongoing traditions that are really still matter, and that the internet is not itself a panacea or a fix-all. Take, for example, like the ways that, you know, campaigners continue to knock on doors, continue to
do bus tours. They don't do train tours anymore, but they still do bus tours, which is another version of that.
Another version of people-to-people communication. And, you know, whether that's through the internet or through the handshake, we need a way of talking about both of them at the same time.
It's interesting you talk about the internet as sort of the facet of the 2008 election. It was interesting to hear how media covered this innovation. In many ways, they started focusing on other things than policy positions because, in fact, I heard so many reporters say, well, you know, if you want to hear about policy positions, you can find that on the internet. Mm-hmm. And it changed journalism's role, or at least I think that was a bad decision, but I think that
it's a little depressing.
It is depressing, but, you know, I have heard several prominent reporters who were talking, you know, when they're asked about, you know, why are you focusing on this in the campaign? Why aren't you talking about policy positions? They said, well, that's available on the internet.
Yeah, this is, to touch on what Ben was saying and also what I was saying a little bit earlier about cable television. You know, one of the problems with the way we often talk about new media technologies is this notion that somehow they're going to connect us, bring us all together, solve problems. But in fact, what it tends to do is it creates ever finer sort of degrees of differentiation within a population. And so, for example, when you have the internet, suddenly you have this whole space for accessing specialized knowledge for special communities, as opposed to, I don't think broadcasting, you know, is this, I don't know, heavenly space where everything was right, but still broadcasting had to speak to everyone all at once. And so you couldn't say, well, this specialized knowledge goes online. And, you know, and so that's one of the tendencies in technology is to create ever finer degrees of difference and almost splintering in the population. And so I think by looking at the history of technology, you can start recognizing some of these tendencies.
My guest today is Bernard Gagan, a research associate at Humboldt University of Berlin. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at 6:30 in Chapman Hall Lecture Hall based on the idea of Kulturtechnik and American liberalism. Now, we're not talking about a contemporary political philosophy. We're talking about the old school Enlightenment and sort of the idea of individual rights. I'm also joined by Ben Peters, who is head of the Digital Studies Group and an assistant professor of communication at the University of Tulsa. They're joining us to talk about language and technology. I guess that's probably the best way to put it today. So what is the connection between this Kulturtechnik and classic American political liberalism, the sort of de Tocqueville sort of vision of America, of individual rights? Is this what you're sort of getting at?
Liberalism is such a slippery word, and, you know, who really knows?
Well, it's been appropriated in all different ways.
Yeah, so many different ways. One of the things that interests me is liberalism partially is just a particular strategy of exchange and communication, right? So when you talk, whether you're talking about freer regimes of trade and also freer speech, you're talking about, I think, communication. And so when you look at the way the so-called founding fathers conceived of the United States, one of the things they're really concerned is, okay, we have this huge territory, and how is it that we don't want a centralized government that controls everything, but we need to connect everyone and bring them all together. One of the ways we're going to do this is we're going to sort of give as much freedom as we can to speech and to trade. And in that, the population will sort of connect and bind itself and almost regulate itself so that you don't need a tyranny or a king to do so. So when I'm looking at liberalism, I'm looking at this partially how this early interest in communication, which ends up linking to things like the printing press and railroads and even canals, how that kind of lays the foundation for a nation that's linked in part by communication technologies.
Yeah. This may not be anything you're trying to get at, but when I hear you talk that way, it's like that sort of describes the way technology has evolved in the last 40 or 50 years, where there's been very few rules. And now what you're starting to see is, you know, the powers that be, the forces that control nations and relations between nations saying, no, we got to get a little bit of a handle on this. You know, I mean, the internet was wild, wild west. A lot of emerging technologies have been, hey, whatever you want to do, it's fine. It's out there.
And also all these, a lot of the debates going on that I think are at the heart of the current election, right? So this question of regulation, do we need to, for example, do we need financial regulation? It's partially a question of how freely are we going to allow money to circulate within the country and also between national borders. Did the economy collapse because you didn't have enough regulation, that you had, you know, too much freedom in communication, so to speak? Or was there some other reason? Everyone has a different villain to blame on this. What interests me is that at least the concept of, I argue that the concept the founding fathers had was that when you allow a certain amount of freedom in speech, it ends up people are in an antagonistic system. People are arguing with one another, and that creates lots of regulations and constraints on what people say and what people do, and it binds people together. And so when one speaks today of, say, it has a libertarianism, people should be able to say and do whatever they want, that's the idea of the founding fathers, it's, you know, completely off base. They were really interested in how do you have a system that creates communication but really profound regulation.
That will be part of the things you'll be talking about tonight?
I think so. You know, there's still, I'm fiddling with it a little bit. There's a question of whether I'll get into all this stuff about liberalism or I'll just discuss the concept of Kultur technik, cultural techniques, cultural technologies. Mm-hmm. There's the in-depth versus the survey. And
Well, let me ask you, as we sort of look at this amalgam between people and technology and how we're so interrelated with our technology, I know you've spent time in Paris, visiting professor there, and now in Germany. Is Europe still grappling with it the same way Americans seem to be doing? You know, today I heard a story on the presidential campaign, and it was talking about one of the campaign's Twitter rapid response strategy. Mm-hmm. And it just, I think there's a disconnect between those who are using technology and those who aren't, mm-hmm. that it just doesn't, you know, there's, I think, profound divisions. Mm-hmm. Is Europe grappling in the same way?
Europe is grappling with these things. I think, like the U.S., I would say they've been grappling with it since at least the 19th century. Because of the effects of modernization and so on. I would say there's a tendency, I get the feeling that in the United States, all these things are a little more extreme because when you have a population, in the United States, you have much more variation in things like education, income, also, regions. And so this ends up multiplying the effect of people having different access to the internet, different use of the internet, and also different tastes and interests. And there's a little more homogeneity for a variety of reasons, probably in France or Germany. But I wouldn't want to overstate that.
Well, you have subcultures, but really they're not integrated, you know, from what I can see. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the subcultures, ethnic subcultures, I mean, they're, you know, you can't be a German citizen and not be from Germany. You know, so that creates all sort of interesting issues too. But getting back to how Europeans are grappling with these issues, one of the things I think you've alluded to in some of your writing is the fact that, you know, Europeans are dealing with a much longer history of inequality and lack of that American liberalism you're talking about, the de Tocqueville. They had to evolve to that. How does that play out into what you're talking about?
Ben might have some ideas about this. One thing that immediately comes to mind is I heard someone say once that there's something sort of a little optimistic about the way Americans think about things. And they say this is because, you know, there is this notion that we were a new country with new possibilities. Hmm. Keep in mind, there were profound problems at the beginning of the United States, right? You look at things like slavery. You don't get more, you know, division in the population than that. But nonetheless...
Yeah, division between landowners and non-landowners.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, they were not really, you know, citizens to the full extent of what we would consider a citizen today. Yeah.
But as a general tendency, the U.S. then and now was interested in what can we do? Let's look towards the future. Whereas I think as a general sense, I think countries like Germany and France, they have a stronger sense of history and struggle. And also things like World War II, it was right in their backyard. And so, you know, they're a little more aware of cultural conflicts and the limits of history and the danger of history than I think Americans are. Hmm.
That's interesting. I mean, I think I would add it's a hard case. It's a harder case. And look at Germany. I mean, Germany in some cases is going through more moderate as well as more extreme struggles. And it just depends on what sort of angle you look at. In those who are privileged enough to be part of the political conversation, I think the general tendency is to be more moderate than in America. I mean, that'd be my offhand observation. But then if you look at, say, the Turks or the Turkish people, who in some cases are third or fourth generation, living in Germany, still without citizenship and in many ways isolated without, you know, speaking German, you know, the reason that their views are not part of the conversation is simply because they're being excluded from the conversation, or they are self-selecting themselves out. I mean, it's a two-way street in this case. But so I think there are, and certainly the Muslim population in France may be a similar parallel, where there's lots of internal discord that is not producing a kind of strategic liberal discourse, but is instead the part set apart from the liberal politics mm-hmm. of the country.
Now, I'm assuming the degree of assimilation is different from ethnic groups coming to the United States than, say, Turks in Germany or the Muslim population, North African Muslims in France. There's a greater degree of still living in their own culture within the country. Is that the case over two or three generations? You know, mm-hmm. the immigrant experience here is second generation, you're American, mm-hmm. and you're also, you know, those ties break really mm-hmm. quickly. Mm-hmm. Do they not break as quickly?
You know, I'd say it cuts both ways, right? Because on one hand, we have this, so one of the ideas of American liberal society is this celebration of multiculturalism. Right, so everyone is a, you know, something / American. So I'm an Irish American, and if I go to Ireland, I tell them I'm Irish. Then I say, "What are you talking about? You've never lived here," right? And so on one hand, you have this celebration of diversity and people from different places in the United States that preserves that, right? On the other hand, so you know, when you go to Europe, France is a great example, right? In France, once you've kind of assimilated, once you've come, if you're a French citizen, you're French. You know, you're not, and you don't refer to yourself by your religious group necessarily or your country of origin. You're a French citizen, full stop. But that also means that if you're not properly integrated, then you're really on the outs somehow, right? So there's less sort of tolerance for ambiguity there than there is in the United States. So on one hand, for example, I think you see a lot of interracial marriage, right? If you're in a city like Paris, of course you see that in the U.S. too. But I think my feeling was you see more of that in Paris because people are integrating and they relate to each other as French people. But then you also have suburbs of, you know, people from, you know, Algeria who are completely marginalized and they're not allowed to sort of exist in this nether space.
And they're sort of insular too. Yeah. I mean, they're not really integrating in any really sense other than, you know, work.
I mean, my perspective on these things tends to be a little more, I think it's the responsibility of a dominant culture to sort of create opportunities for people to participate. And so I think when you have, and you see this, of course, in the U.S. too, right, when you have major differences in educational institutions and, you know, the infrastructure of a city, and then people seem to get stuck and not participate fully in the culture, I'm hesitant to blame the so-called subculture. You know, I mm-hmm. tend to think there's something wrong in the way that nation thinks of its people and what it means to belong. You know,
my guests today are Bernard Gagan, a research associate at Humboldt University of Berlin, Ben Peters, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Tulsa, who coordinates the digital studies group. Now, you're bringing in Bernard to speak. Very briefly, what is the digital studies group? What sort of things are you looking at?
The digital studies group is a startup initiative started last fall. It's a group of anyone who's interested. We welcome all who are interested in learning and exploring and advancing ways that we can use digital technologies to enhance our learning, to think about changes in society, as well as to also help us do new things. So it's for those who would like to think about the stakes as well as the possibilities that come with digital technologies. Mm-hmm. It brings in a broad collection of faculty here at TU. There's people here largely in the arts and sciences who are already thinking about these topics, as well as a cluster of people over in electrical engineering and computer sciences, And when we get together and we have music people and art people and engineers in the same room, and we talk about common keywords. We also bring in bring in guests and have events. For example, there's a bring in an electrical engineer and an English professor and tell them to talk about games. And you'll get very different yet strangely compatible discussions. One will talk about resource allocation of computational processes, and the other one will talk about narrative design and, you know, the sort of multiple ways
the story.
That a game
yeah,
can
the story.
Unfold. The
yeah.
story.
Yeah.
And yet the two are the same thing. And there's an opportunity here for us to create, you know, richer conversations for it.
All right. Well, people can learn more tonight at Chapman Hall, Lecture Hall. Bernard and Ben, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Bernard Gagan is a research associate at Humboldt University of Berlin. Ben Peters is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Tulsa who coordinates the Digital Studies Group. The Digital Studies Group has invited Gagan to speak tonight at 6:30 in Chapman Hall, a lecture hall on the TU campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. As we grapple with new technology, we know that technology can create class divides. And speaking of class divides, our medical commentator, Dr. John Schumann, documents yet another way the super rich are different from the rest of us.
I've been having trouble finding quality medical care aboard my yacht lately. Thank goodness Guardian 24/7 is working tirelessly to fill this vital niche. Recently, somebody sent me a link to this beyond swanky sounding service. At first glance, I was fairly certain I was reading from the pages of The Onion, but this is no joke. Here are some of the marketing claims from their website. Quote, founded by former White House physicians and doctors for advanced medical planning, Guardian 24/7 offers medical protection previously available only to the President of the United States. We work with your physicians to design a system perfectly suited to your unique needs. Guardian 24/7 is not for everyone, but it just might be for you, end quote. Yeah, it just might be for you if you're insanely wealthy, a touch paranoid, and have an interest in trying to live forever. You won't find prices listed anywhere on the Guardian 24/7 website, but a New York Times article about the service quoted a price of between $6,000 and $12,000 per month, in addition to the $700,000 necessary to install one of their ready rooms on your yacht or in your home. Heck, you can even get one installed on your plane. For true amusement, I watched the video on their website at guardian247.com. Yeah, that looks a lot like my estate. Who wouldn't want to turn their bedroom into a hospital room with the touch of a button? Again, from their website, quote, before Guardian, this kind of medical protection was only available to one person. But now, presidential-level care can be yours, on your schedule and your terms, end quote. I'm not certain about it, but I don't think they mean Michael Jackson.
Dr. John Henning Schumann is our medical commentator here on Studio Tulsa. He teaches at OU Tulsa and writes the blog Glass Hospital. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you want to listen to one of our recent shows, they're available online at publicradiotulsa.org. And while you're there, check out our new website. Lots of things to discover, as well as old Studio Tulsas. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.